This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Steve Jorgensen and for Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. For those of you who like a love story, today's book is titled Winning Customer Love. The focus of a business makes all the difference, and our author is Jim Buchanan. Jim, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much, Jay. I'm glad to be here.
Interested in your book, I'm assuming, has primarily the target audience of a business owner or an individual who is trying to build a business. Tell me about the background. What inspired you to write this particular book?
Well, it's absolutely targeted to business owners and business leaders really at all levels, Jay. It came through to me from kind of the convergence of three things. As I reflected on a little bit over a 40-year business career, and when I had success and when I had less than success, I really zeroed in on the fact that when we were focused on our employees and our customers and doing our best for them, we always had great results. Secondly, I started to look at the businesses that I love and talk to people about the businesses that they love, and it sort of started to crystallize around a bunch of common threads of why people love the businesses they deal with. And then the third thing is I went through a fairly significant, you know, transformation in my life personally. And out of that, in part, I learned about the law of attraction and the fact that, you know, as we go through life, whatever we're giving out is what we're going to get back. And that absolutely applies to businesses as well.
You mentioned the law of attraction. That is a key phrase that comes up in a lot of different industries and a lot of different contexts. What do you feel is the easiest way for an individual like me or the guy on the street or the individual on the street, the lady on the street who is in business, how do they attract customers and business to them?
Well, it's very straightforward in our personal lives, and you know, we experience it many, many times a day. We give a smile, we get a smile in return. We give kindness, we're likely to get kindness in return. And that's really the law of attraction. Whatever we're giving out is what we're going to get back, and we're giving out positive things and good things, that's what we get in return. And of course, if we're giving out negative things like anger or frustration or jealousy or greed, we're going to get, you know, that back to us. And so when you think about businesses, they're really just collections of people giving to other people who happen to be customers. And so the concept absolutely applies to each and every business in the world, that what they give out is what they're going to give back. And so the premise of my book is really a framework for the things that businesses can do, and many businesses do in fact do, to give love to their customers and to their employees, and that's what they're getting back.
Well, giving love to an employee is, I think, a key ingredient to keeping a business successful. Highlight for us and for my listeners a couple of the companies that you have underscored that really do it right.
Well, first of all, let me just be clear that I'm really talking about a framework of five things that these businesses do. And they are very quickly beauty, generosity, empathy, gratitude, and an everlasting commitment to these five principles, to constantly improving. And so, you know, when I look and talk to people about, you know, why do you love Starbucks? Well, they love Starbucks because they have a beautiful product, and they are generous in how they provide rewards for frequent purchases. They have a lot of empathy. Their next products and what they come up with for customers is really feeling what those customers want next. I get a lot of gratitude when I go to Starbucks. I don't know about you, but the baristas are friendly, the attitude of employees is great, and they have an everlasting commitment to this. As far as I'm concerned, you know, they've been doing it from start to finish. And I look at a lot of other companies like Apple and Nordstrom and Amazon and Google, and the way they run their businesses, just as a few examples, is to really deliver on these five principles. And not only to customers, but they have to deliver it to employees as well, because you know, after all, Jay, the employee is the one who's really interacting with the customer. So if the barista doesn't feel loved, no matter what they're doing at headquarters at Starbucks, I'm not likely to feel the love. So they have to do it internally as well as through to the customers.
A recently successful television program that has arisen in the last couple, 3 years is Undercover Boss, which underscores the importance of seeing things from the ground up as far as a business.
Funny you bring that up, because it's actually I spent some time talking about that in my second book, which will be out this summer, and it's called Winning Employee Love. So it's a deeper dive into how businesses and leaders can do this internally. And I talked about Undercover Boss and how that's really, you know, a leader putting themselves in the shoes of, you know, maybe we'll call them frontline employees who are out there dealing with customers and are expected to, you know, deliver whatever the company strategy is to those customers. And so, you know, boy, if they don't feel the love from their boss and from headquarters and the way the company operates, it's just not going to work.
That's part of ownership, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, think about it. Businesses have such a huge responsibility. You know, many of us go to work for businesses and spend most of our waking hours there. And it's the future of our families, you know, educate our children, take care of our health care, set up our retirement. And you just think about that obligation that every business has. And, you know, you wonder, or I wonder, how they can't set themselves up to just have a very loving attitude to that commitment from employees.
Have you noticed any businesses out there that need to adapt this strategy? Perhaps they haven't gotten the message yet.
Well, it's kind of my two poster children for that would be the major airlines and big banks. And I spent a lot of years in my career living on major airlines, so I know lots about them, as I'm sure many of our listeners do. And I worked for a major bank for 12 years, so I understand, you know, the ins and outs of that industry. They just have so much room for improvement, and I know there are tons of good people there in the leadership teams, and I know a lot of them personally in banking. And so it's not that they can't do this, it's just that they haven't sort of, you know, headed in this direction in a committed way yet.
Have you noticed any difference in unionized shops or businesses and non-unionized businesses?
Well, it's, again, in a little bit in this book, Winning Customer Love, and in the next book, I spend a fair amount of time on unions. And you know, unions exist simply because management can't be trusted. And that could be a, you know, decades old, even centuries old problem in a given business or industry. Could be a fairly recent problem, but fundamentally, employees feel like they need outside legal support to be treated fairly. And so I fault the management teams wherever I see a union. But having managed union companies, We absolutely did these fundamentals to both our union operations and our non-union operations without any differentiation. So I just really ignored the union contract and said, you know, we're going to give love to our employees. We're going to treat them right. We're going to deliver on these five fundamental principles. And then we're going to look to their help to do the same for customers, whether they're unionized or not. So this can work in both environments. It's absolutely up to management.
Have you come across any proof that the love strategy actually works to improve business performance?
Well, Apple is the most valuable corporation of all time, based on, you know, the shareholder ownership of that company. Google's been number one, certainly in the top five or ten. I mean, every one of the companies that I talk about in my book make billions of dollars in profit. And, you know, when you listen to how they operate their businesses and when you listen to what's important to them, when you look at what they do, many of these companies are on the annual surveys about the best places to work. And so you see how they operate, and it's just crystal clear. This is what they do, and the result is they're extremely successful financially.
Chapter 1 deals with winning customer love, and then Chapter 2, winning employee love. And from there it goes to beauty, generosity, empathy, gratitude, and Chapter 7 intrigues me. Everlasting. Explain what the content of that chapter has to do with customer love.
Well, it's a little bit of a play on words, I'll confess that. So everlasting love, you know, maybe a term many of us have heard and certainly hope for. The idea is that this isn't a once-and-done sort of approach. You can't focus on beauty, generosity, empathy, and gratitude one time and then move on. It's got to be the constant focus, the strategy. This is really all we do is pay attention to these five things for our employees and our customers to be successful. And beyond that, we've got to have an everlasting commitment to improvement. So customers may love our products today. They're not going to be good enough to continue to win their love tomorrow, next year, 10 years from now. Same thing with how we interact with employees and what employees need from us as leaders is going to change over time. And so it's really a commitment to continuous improvement.
And who is going to benefit the most from embracing and learning about the concept in your book?
Well, I think it's business leaders, again, at all levels of an organization, and in two ways. To help the business adopt and implement, if you will, this strategy, can take the business to its fullest potential. There's no doubt in my mind about that. It's a shift from a focus on profit and cost and efficiency to a shift to a focus on love and to the people that are being served internally and externally. And for a leader to embrace this and to help lead their organization forward to a much higher level of performance is absolutely going to help their individual career. So sort of a individual leader improvement plan as well as an overall business improvement plan.
Share with my listeners in a couple of sentences how you would introduce this book to them.
I would say that winning customer love is about a business strategy and leadership principles to win the love of millions of customers, to take the business and your personal career to the fullest potential. It's pretty obvious that loving customers buy more, they're incredibly loyal, they give rave reviews, which is, you know, ever increasingly important in social media. They bring their family, their friends, and their neighbors in to do business with you as well. And so I think everybody understands the power of that approach. And, you know, lots of businesses, and I've experienced this in my career, have customers that are indifferent. You know, they'll buy from us sometimes, other times they won't. Always about price, pitting competitors against us to win their business, that sort of thing. And indifferent employees who, you know, they may do what they're told, but they're not really putting their hearts and minds into what we're trying to accomplish in the business. And they're, you know, there may be absenteeism problems and that sort of thing. So this shift from a focus on profit and cost to a shift on people and on delivering love through these five principles will absolutely take a business and a career to the fullest potential.
Well, Jim, one thing I do like about your book, among other things, is the fact that it's a short read, 108 pages. You haven't wasted time getting lost in the weeds. You've gotten to the point and give some great advice. Is this book different from others in the marketplace that deal with business and how to retain customers and get loyalty from them?
Well, thanks, Jay, for noting the short, and I'm going to say sweet. You didn't say that, but I really think simplicity is important. And so many business strategy books and leadership fundamental books get very in-depth, very complex, and I think this is very simple and straightforward. That doesn't mean it's easy to implement because it's going to take as much or more effort to do this strategy as any other strategy. It's very different in the sense that, you know, I'm talking about love in the workplace, and I don't see a lot of reference to that in terms of strategy and a leadership approach, which is interesting to me because as individual leaders, you know, we obviously highly value love in every other aspect of our life. So, you know, we love having breakfast with our children in the morning, and we love going home to our family in the evening, and we love taking up our hobby when we have an opportunity to do so and that sort of thing. So why shouldn't love be a part of what we're bringing to work every day as well is, I think, an important question.
Jim, this is your first book. Were there any challenges that approached you as you were trying to get this published?
Well, it was a learning experience all the way along. You know, really started with how do I write? How do I develop a writing style? How do I get into a discipline of writing? And so, you know, this book took me about 18 months to write. And then I had to learn the publishing process. So that was another sort of 6 months of a process. And, you know, I think for book two, it's been much more straightforward, and book three and beyond, you know, easier still. So, you know, it just takes time to learn how to do it, like anything new.
The title of this book is Winning Customer Love, The Focus of a Business Makes All the Difference. And our author is Jim Buchanan. Jim, where do we get copies of your book?
Well, the book will release on April 22nd. It'll be available at my website, winningcustomerlove.com. It'll be available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the other you know, typical book outlets. It'll be available in an e-version, soft cover, and hardcover. And I will say that in about 2 weeks' time, so around April 15th, I'll be offering 500 free copies via my website, again, winningcustomerlove.com. So listeners may want to check my site out and get a free copy that I'll send to them. And all I hope for is that they'll provide their comments back to Amazon, back to social media, back to me. I just love to hear how people feel about the book.
Thanks, Jim, for sharing the story behind the writing of the book, Winning Customer Love. Thank you for joining me today.
Thanks very much, Jay. I'm really grateful. I appreciate it.
For Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press, this is Jay Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Hi, everybody. This is Pete Dix of Beatles and Beyond. Why don't we all come together and hear some of the tracks off the latest Beatles release on this radio station? Yes, why don't you look up the schedules on this radio station and join me and Beatles listeners everywhere to hear these latest releases from the Beatles on Beatles and Beyond with Pete Dix.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Into the Mouths of Babes, a Whole Foods Nutrition Guide to Feeding Your Infants and Toddlers, and the author is Susan Tate. And Susan joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Balboa Press. Hello, Susan.
Hi, Steve.
Great to have you with us. As you say, this is way more than a book about infant nutrition and recipes. It's really about love. Well, that's it covers every aspect of life, because there is a lot said in your book about nutrition and recipes for babies, but it's really about love. So before we get into learning some different details about your book, tell us about your background, Susan, and how this book came about.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Thank you. And I love that you started with love. I love love. So I created this book idea sitting on the bed when I was pregnant with my first child in 1976. And I had this aha moment of, oh my gosh, we have to feed him. Like, we're the ones responsible for his nourishment, let alone his upbringing, but all of a sudden the food became really important. And my background is a health educator, and I'm very passionate about making sure that we're all healthy and well. And so I went on this pretty fast quest to make sure that I could find everything possible to gather information and the latest research on how to best feed him. And I didn't, we're going to be vegetarians, and I wanted to raise him on a vegetarian diet. We were vegetarians, and I wanted to make sure that was safe for him. And at the time, there really wasn't any infant nutrition book specifically that said how to feed a child without meat. And my book actually does not have meat or fish in it, but it's very friendly and open to adding it. It's not, you must be this, or it's not anything. I don't tell you, I don't guilt trip anybody, by the way. So after several years of learning how to make baby food and literally squirting my own breast milk in rice cereal that I had made for him, I ground up the rice and was really the earth mama at the time, and gathered recipes and research. And then our second child came along 4 years later, and after she was born, not that I had time, but somehow I really wanted to share this with other parents. And so the first edition of Into the Mouths of Babes was created in 1984. The second edition came about when I was an assistant professor in the School of Medicine at the University of Virginia, and I was the head of the Department of Health Promotion. And new things had come out, so I updated that book. And then about 5 years ago, my daughter, Molly, said, "Mama, you need to bring this book back out again. All my friends are having babies. Please, please, you know, get this book back out again." And so I spent the past 5 years researching in a completely different way than going to the library and looking at books and journals, everything online and sorting through the maze. And thus, the third edition of Into the Mouths of Babes was born.
Well, I love this reviewer. This reviewer said, "Reading this book is like having a loving godmother in your kitchen, holding your hand while you learn to deeply enjoy feeding your family." What a great compliment that is.
Thank you. That was Kate Short Lindsay, who's a holistic coach and mama herself. And that endorsement melted my heart, because it does tell people that I'm not doing blame, shame, or guilt. And what I found in some other books are that you have to do it my way, you have to do it this way, or you're wrong. And oh my gosh, you know, parents have so many irons on the fire. And I know I don't like to be told that I'm wrong, and I like to be supported. So people really like that element of finding someone just kind of over their shoulder. I love how she said, "I was a loving godmother." Mm-hmm. Thanks for saying that. That melted my heart.
So really, you are honoring everyone's intuition, their own feelings about what's the best decisions.
Absolutely, Steve. And one of the challenges of this third edition was, because of the internet and because of the extent of having worldwide libraries in front of me, I had to really sort through what I was going to extract and what was really the most important. And what I found repeatedly was that there was so much conflicting research, and I could find five nutritionists that would say one thing and five that would say another, and who do you believe? And Joshua Rosenthal, who's the founder of the Institute for Integrative Medicine, has a wonderful quote. He says something like, "Nutrition is the only field where you can, you know, prove and disprove alternate theories, and everybody's right." And I read that and I felt a little more at ease, because I thought, oh, I really want to be accurate. I want to make sure these studies weren't done by food companies or, you know, somebody that had a financial interest, so I could look at how I was taught to research. But really, the overriding concept with how I encourage mothers, fathers, and other caregivers to make decisions is, look at everything and then let your intuition override everything. You may know something about your child that some nutritionist really doesn't know, and honor that intuition.
So you get real focused. You get real focused. Beginner recipes, I guess that's the first 6 months. Then you go to intermediate, 7 to 9 months, advanced, 10 to 12 months, toddler, 1 to 3 years, whole family recipes. I mean, you get very specific here as well.
I do. I really provide a guide, starting with prenatal nutrition. I have a chapter called Into the Mouths of Future Moms. And then that 6 month, the beginner recipes begin at 6 months. But prior to that,
oh, right.
I Yes. So we don't want to feed them cereal early or anything like that, or avocados too early. So I give an overview of breastfeeding and bottle feeding, formula feeding. And again, I don't guilt trip anyone. Of course, I advocate, please, if you can breastfeed, you know, it's the best that, you know, milk we can offer. And some people adopt and some people cannot breastfeed. Mm-hmm. And again, I don't guilt trip anybody. I give you all the reasons and all the support for that. And then at 6 months, we start with the first recipe is avocado auto, and just mashing an avocado and gently feeding that to baby is a good way. And then I wanted a follow-up so that this could extend into family recipes. I actually have so many people that are buying this and their children are older, and they're looking at that loving intention and going to the family recipes.
And, of course, along with all this great nutrition, you also say, feed your child the 7 sacred nutrients. Explain those.
Oh, Steve, thank you for asking me that, because that's the centerpiece of this edition. So as I gathered all of the research, and I give a very good background on, you know, your basic nutrients, your proteins, carbs, fats, fibers, water, things that we know are nutrients, things that we, our body needs. And I decided to add a layer of what I call sacred nutrients. And these are, I picked 7. I'm sure there are far more, but the 7 that came to me are joy, wisdom, respect, quality, safety, pleasure, and the greatest of these is love. And they can be given in unlimited quantities at any age. And it overrides for me the sense of, oh my gosh, how do I put this? How do I do that? If I'm, you know, feeding myself and feeding others, and if parents and caregivers are feeding their babies with this sense of joy at the table and wisdom, the best that they can do, and respect for their baby's tastes and the quality of the food, making sure that you do the very best you can. I could do another book or chapter on making sure that we really do not give our children genetically modified or genetically engineered foods. And those are some of those are hidden. They're mostly in packages, so go for vegetables more than anything. Safety, you know, making sure that there's kindness around the table and that there's nobody bullying anybody or yelling at anybody. And pleasure, adding the senses to color on the plate and sounds and sights, and then put this, infuse it with love. Like, it's just, that's a nourishing meal for a baby, a toddler, you, me, our grandchildren, everybody.
Sure. Now, you are specific, though, as well, about what not to put into the mouths of babes.
I do have a chapter that with poison control and making sure that our houses are safe and our apartments are safe, in that we don't want them, well, one of the things I keep thinking is in any plastics or any toxins, and making sure that our homes are safe with our babies. And I think most parents are really pretty good about safety proofing their homes. The other thing, I'm not sure if you're going to ask me a question, I do have a chapter on some basic food allergies. And one of the things I learned about food allergies from the first edition a long time ago, and it all stands true, is, you know, food allergies can come, you know, a child can have, say, strawberries for years, and at age 8 they develop an allergy to strawberries. Like, what is that about? I don't know why they that really happens, but it does. And so I share some basic information on that. And I also have a chapter that provides, you know, things like gluten-free recipes. Gluten is a huge problem. That's another phone call for many, many children these days. You know, when you and I were raising our children, the wheat that was grown in the United States wasn't as genetically engineered and modified as it is now. It was grown in really good soil, and the technology was very different. And so I have to say, like 10 years ago when the gluten-free information came out, I was puzzled, and I thought, what is that? And mm-hmm. so with our babies today, really looking at wheat and gluten. So I had a chapter years ago that was wheat-free recipes, egg-free, and milk-free. So I added the gluten-free. There's a whole chapter on that and a guide to help babies and infants with that.
Well, very good. Susan Tate, we've been listening to her. She's the author of her book, Into the Mouths of Babes. How do we get your book, Susan?
Oh, thank you for asking. You can go to my website, www.susantate.org. That's SusanTate. You'll find lots of information there. I actually have another recent book called Wellness Wisdom, 31 Ways to Nourish Your Mind, Body, and Spirit. And that will be a great way. I'd love for people to sign up for my newsletter and to check that. They can get it on Amazon. They can get it through Balboa Press. Libraries can get it through Ingram's. And one request I have of listeners is I really want, of course I want this book to be a bestseller. I'd be lying if I didn't say that. But beyond that, I want it to nourish children across the globe in any way that it can. So I really ask people if they would please request the book to have in their library so that lots of people could have it in their library. Or ask your pediatrician if you can donate one to the waiting room so that lots of people could just pick up, they'll read just exactly what they need to know.
Thank you so much, Susan, for being with us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you, Steve. I really appreciated our time together.
And this interview has been brought to everyone by Balboa Press.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 central on toginet.com. Helen Wu was born and raised in San Francisco's Chinatown, and after a very difficult upbringing, fighting depression, abuse, and addictions, she finally finds herself genuinely happy inside and out. Helen believes in taking our positive thinking and doing something positive to achieve a positive outcome. She's here to make a positive difference in your life, to be your game changer, your aha moment mentor. She's ready to help both men and women get into a better place. Helen Wu is also the author of Self-Aid Success Stories, 25 Success Stories from Successful Entrepreneurs. Inspired by Ellen DeGeneres, Helen wants the world to know that just because we find ourselves in a difficult situation doesn't mean we have to stay there. We can aid ourselves to a better life. So join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 central on toginet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Steve Jorgensen and for Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The prologue to this offering reads like this. Blackness overtook Daniel, and he found himself hurtling through a black void and heading somewhere out in space, out amongst the brilliance of the never-ending universe. Approaching him in the distance was a round light with a streaking tail. It headed straight for another larger, brighter sphere, which appeared familiar to him. He recognized it, the moon. A comet was on collision course with Earth's moon. So begins the story of the book titled The Leader of the World, The Last Messenger. And our author, joining me from Australia, is E. Mann. Welcome, sir. Welcome, Emmanuel.
Good day, Jay.
Good yes,
to be with you.
It's
all the way from down under Australia.
Early morning there, and you've already had your first cup of tea, which is a great way to start the morning.
Should have had a whiskey or something, I think.
The book, The Leader of the World, The Last Messenger. Tell me the inspiration behind writing this book, which is 377 pages. Now, my understanding is it's actually the adventure takes place in the future.
Yes, it does, in the near future, 2025. It's a big question you just asked me there, because it probably takes some time to answer. So I'll try not to get on my soapbox about it. What inspired me is kind of strange. I was traveling in the outback of Australia, the barren desert land in the middle of the continent. And one night, I was looking up at the brilliance of the countless stars, and I wondered if I was actually looking at the God or the Creator itself. And I asked myself that question, am I actually looking at God's body? And it's hard for me to explain this, but the story came to me almost instantly. And as soon as I returned home, I was compelled to write it. I actually had the first draft finished in a few weeks.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was just, I found it hard to sleep at nights, and I was up most nights at my computer. I wrote over 230,000 words, which for a first attempt at a novel, I think is extremely large. And actually the publisher made me cut it back. There's so many things happening in this world. I could just make one comment before I go much further. I can't believe it, but I wrote this book. It's a fiction. And I was afraid to use my real name as the author. I mean, I changed my identity. Now, this is Australia. And like America and most Western countries, we have freedom of speech. But do we really? Just because I mention particular religious groups in a derogatory way, I started to worry, and I wasn't just concerned about the Islamic fanatics either. I found that Christian fanatics can be just as bad. It should not be like that. I should be able to comment on any given... I should be able to give my opinion on anything I want, with the exception of downright racism, because I believe it's the only way the world can progress and better itself. If we criticize in a positive way, we'll only improve our way of life.
Explain the aspect of The Last Messenger. Now, is Daniel your main character in the book, or is there another character that takes that role?
No, Daniel is the main character. Daniel is the actual messenger, and it's his job. He has to basically save the world. The world's got so bad. This part of the Creator's body, the way I can see things, is that we're all part of God or the Creator, and Daniel's been given the task of bringing the people of the earth back to the path, the previous messengers like Jesus and Muhammad, for example, that they said we've gone off that path and we need to get back to it, because it's like cancer. It has to be cut out to save a person. Sometimes cancerous growth has to be cut out, and the earth has become a cancerous growth on the Creator's body. And Daniel is basically the doctor. He's a surgeon. If he can't cure this cancer, then the earth would be destroyed.
How is Daniel get selected? What is the uniqueness about him that makes him an ideal candidate to be the messenger?
Well, it's another hard question. It's just, I don't want to give away the story completely, but he just happened to be probably in the right place at the right time. And probably one reason Australia was picked is because of its diverse multicultural society. And Daniel starts off by using the Aboriginals, the Indigenous people of Australia. He tries to get them, which are only about 1 or 2% of the Australian population, but it's a bit like the American Indians. They're going through a bad time, and they've lost respect for themselves. And he has to try and get them back on track. And basically what they have to do is they have to go along with the... they're invaders.
And that happens with a lot of indigenous people, like the people of the United States. We have the native Indian population of several different tribes. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I have some very close friends who are native-born Indian families. And I'm sure that background, that history is very challenging for them to overcome some of the obstacles that they have faced as an independent tribe wanting to have their own culture and stay separate from the rest of the culture that's invaded them.
Well, the way I look at it, these indigenous people all over the world, unfortunately and regrettably, have been given no real choice but to conform with the invaders of the country. If they're to survive in their own land, they must realize that that's the case, and they've really got to use the invaders' way of life to ensure their own survival. They should be taking advantage of any aid they're given by governments, and do not waste any opportunity to progress their lives. And that's the message that Bendall gets across, tries to get across to the Aboriginals in Australia. And he starts his campaign, because the way it works out is it's like a big jigsaw puzzle. You've got to take little pieces and put them in the right place. So he goes about finding willing and unwilling helpers to help him with his task to save the earth. He'll do anything to try and save the world. A bit like a modern Jesus Christ, okay? Where Jesus taught us to love our neighbour. He hasn't got time to tolerate people who won't help him to get his task completed.
Are there specific scenes in here? I'm sure you've got some outstanding adventure parts of this book that would really grab a reader's attention. Name a couple of those scenes that you think are outstanding and what you've come up with in your creativity here.
Okay. I've got basically the whole story starts off in Australia and encompasses all parts of the world in the end, okay, because there's no choice in this. He has to travel all over the world and fix up all the problems that he comes across. One example, okay, if I can read from the book here. The Inca plunged his spear into the chest of the man, lifting him above his head and threw him into the murky water. The man screamed as the waiting alligators tore the meal to pieces. Another one in Africa, something grabbed Daniel's hand and looking down, he saw the terrified eyes of the headman's daughter. Her bloody little body collapsed and lay dead at his feet. Daniel's whole body began to tremble, and a fury he had not experienced before encompassed him. A roar emanated from deep inside him. The sound was so intimidating that the terrified villagers moved away from him and back towards their huts. The rebels momentarily froze, and Daniel stood alone amongst the dozens of lifeless bodies facing the armed men.
Well, those are pretty exciting ideas that are flashing before my eyes. Now, as Daniel is traveling throughout the earth, how does he get from point A to point B, or get from one point of the country or from the world to another point?
Okay, the whole group of people his followers, Daniel realizes that for him to do anything in this world, you need to have money. So he sets about making money, and he makes a lot of money very easily, because he is a messenger and he's sort of got powers beyond normal humans. He slowly learns how his powers develop as he goes along. He gets stronger and stronger. And he starts to have control over the actual elements, Earth's elements. So he could travel by simply disappearing, becoming part of the air itself. And he can travel just by the wind itself. The other way is also because he's got so much money, he's also got a Learjet.
Well, Learjet always works. Yeah. And the fact that he is a very successful and wealthy man, that's actually patterned after your own life, correct?
At one stage it was.
Now, tell me how you'd introduce this book to someone, a friend or someone that doesn't know you, in a couple of sentences. How would you define your book?
I'd probably say a divine messenger has an unknown time limit to ensure that the caretakers, which is the humans, of our planet, revert back to the path that previous messages inspired them to follow. And failure means the total destruction of the Earth.
There are a lot of science fiction adventure books in the marketplace. Yours, I'm sure, has a different bend to it. What makes it different from others?
I suppose it takes many relevant topics, relevant to today's world too, and it sets them up almost as short stories within one major story.
And this story takes place in the future tense. Are there some underlying themes that you would say are the key messages you're trying to portray?
Well, it's quite a few. The book itself would appeal to people who've always imagined that there has to be a higher power which created everything, that all we see and have was not just a lucky accident. I suppose the important thing that people should take from this book is maybe, the importance of respecting our world and all its inhabitants.
Good themes, absolutely, and a universal message. Was there a challenge, a specific challenge that that hit you as you were trying to get this book produced, either in the storyline or in the production side?
Well, I've had family members, okay, where I've had AIDS come into my life, not me personally, but I've had family. I've had family with drug problems, okay. And so it was so hard. It was very hard for me not to hurt people's feelings in the book. It was basically an impossibility. And I loved having the power with my imagination to help the downtrodden and having the ability to actively solve so many world problems. It's a bit like pedophilia, and that just bringing a gang of pedophiles to a justifiable end was very gratifying.
So you've gotten your feet wet in the idea of being a writer, a novelist.
Yes.
Is this exciting enough that you'd want to continue, or are you still planning?
Yes, no. I've got another book in mind, but I've also got this bucket list. I've been trying to list things off it as I go along. I'm getting on in age now, and I just want to make sure I fulfill my bucket list, and one of them was writing a novel.
Fabulous. And I understand you also want to bungee jump and maybe even climb the Himalayas. Have you done any of those yet?
No, I've done all that. I started off, I wanted to build a house. I'm not a builder, and I actually built a house. And I think that's one reason my first divorce came about. It took me 6 years to build my own house, like bricklaying and that type of thing. I did it all myself.
Oh, my.
You know? So I climbed a mountain in the Himalayas. That was a technical climb, 6,189 meters above sea level. And basically, five of us started off, and I was the oldest, and I'm the only one that made it.
Amazing.
To the top.
Amazing.
Yeah, and the amazing part there, which I can't understand, is that I didn't have to take one tablet, like all my friends were taking all sorts of tablets to stop.
To keep the oxygen levels.
Altitude sickness. I don't have to take one pill, which I can't understand, because we're all the same fitness, but it's how your body reacts to a low level of oxygen.
Perhaps it's your heritage. You were born in Malta and made it to Australia and grew there, and perhaps it's something to do with your heritage.
Maybe, but Malta's a little island in the Mediterranean, and it's right down at sea level. I got to over 6,000 meters above sea level, and it didn't affect me. So it just amazed me how that happened. I was really worried about it, and like one of my friends had to be taken off by helicopter.
Oh, my.
And when that happens, you really have to come down very quickly, otherwise you could quite easily die.
Mm.
I've done my bungee jump and white water rafting, hot air ballooning, parasailing, wrote this novel.
Manuel, have you always had a desire to write a book and be an author of this type of adventure?
Yes, I have a lot of things on my bucket list, and definitely writing a book was one of them. I actually started one a long time ago based on my own life, but after about 60 pages, I realized that I was being too honest, and that I was going to hurt some people, sued by others, and be alone for the rest of my life. So I couldn't be totally honest, and it was no good writing it. Years later, I wrote this fictitious novel based on my concept and perception of world affairs, current and past, be they religious, history, political, etc. I've just been always been interested and amazed how differently people will construe one particular subject in so many ways. This is all based on my concept. But some people won't like it, but they've got to remember just the way I have looked at things in past history, how I perceive them.
And the reader needs to remember, this is fiction.
That's right. Like I said before, I had to change my name because I was worried about what religious group might think about me criticizing them.
Well, once I get finished reading your book, I do know where you live. So if anybody needs to chase you down, they can write me and I'll let them know.
I can't do that.
Well, this book that you have completed, which was your first novel, is called The Leader of the World, The Last Messenger, 377 pages of adventure set in 2025, and our author is E. Mann. Mr. Mann, where can we get copies of your book?
Well, it can be ordered online in most book sites. Angus and Robertson and Amazon Books, Balboa Press, of course. And hopefully soon to be in those good bookshops.
Fabulous. And I know that you're working on a website that will develop eventually. In the meantime, our listeners can find you by searching online for E, initial, last name, Mann, M-A-N-N, and probably find you on Facebook and on Twitter. So I look forward to talking with you in the future about your newer novel that you're working on at the present, along with your latest accomplishment that has been a part of your bucket list that you've completed.
Thank you very much, Jay.
Emmanuel, thank you for visiting with me today. For Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.